Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and boy, oh boy. Well, actually, let me get through the obligatories because it's swimming hole time. We're going to go down a rat hole and start swimming. Folks, it's all about constitutional compliance. Every waking day, every argument that I have, nine times out of ten, we get into these minutiae, or the details and so forth, and people want to, you know, protect their little myopic things, this and that. Folks, if we all united in demanding full compliance of the Constitution, could you imagine how all of our problems go away? The national debt goes away. I mean, the national debt's fraud already, but once we unite and prove that it's fraud, it goes away. Once we unite and prove they don't have the authority to do all these things, all the regulations that are being basically levied upon your state go away. Why is that a bad thing? Why can't you just, you know, shut up and get involved in supporting the Constitution instead of cherry picking the one part of the Constitution you like and turning your back on the rest of the Constitution? Now, we have, and we believe in supporting candidates that take that position. Jerry Wistrand is that guy. If you're not supporting Jerry Wistrand, then you're in the wrong space and time. If you want to support these guys because you like them, because they fit your narrative, or they're that ideal person in the beauty contest, we need to start reevaluating, because we're in this mess. Your state governments are attacking you. The federal government's been attacking us for years and still is. Even with Trump at the helm, they're still attacking us. The only way we're going to stop this is by holding every public servant accountable in demanding compliance to the Constitution. They are legally bound when they step into office to support that Constitution. That's why we want you to start contributing one way or the other. Let's get Jerry some help. The primary is about a month and a half away, I believe. I hope Jerry forgives me. He's been having these meetings and I've not been able to attend. And so I might as well just publicly shame myself right now because I know he needs all the help. And I'm doing everything I can on this end to get him some financial help, because I do get his reports, and he needs money. He needs money, folks. It takes a little bit of gas in your tank to get somewhere, just a little bit. You know, I understand things can happen on prayers, but you got to have a little gas to get the car started. Anyway, all right. You know, with a good wind at your back, you know, tornado or a series of tornadoes to pick you up and carry you and fling you down. Anyway, we are in the ratification debate, but before we dive in there, we got to go back. And I want to deal with the specific go back that was brought up, because we were talking about this hybrid republic and how, for the most part, for the first 100 some plus years, it was very reasonable for the county governments, because government was not that involved in our life. You didn't need, at the county level, they were pretty much, you know, I don't want to say hands off. They did sales tax and those types of things. But for the federal government was, you know, they were pretty much hands off for the first century or so, until they started getting away with nationally aggrandizing their powers during the progressive eras, the first and second progressive eras. But the states started growing their powers. And next thing you know, they start basically co-opting your county governments and getting your county governments to basically invoke their warfare tactics against you. Most of the stuff that your county's doing, the state doesn't have the authority to tell them to do that, nor does the federal government, nor do the bureaucracies have any authority. When we look at this model, this hybrid constitutional republic, it wasn't until we started finally getting to a point where we actually started creating sewage systems. We started creating, you know, public utilities. Pretty much the 20th century is when government really started expanding and improving the quality of life by getting the poop out of the street and getting it processed and, you know, in a clean manner so that we could kind of keep a clean environment, because people were dying. Back during the Constitutional Convention, people were dying from typhoid, yellow fever, from poop in the river, and so forth. I mean, back in those days, you know, the cure was bloodletting. And if that didn't kill you, then okay, they cured you. But the bottom line is, we are now at a point where there is a good argument. And as a matter of fact, welcome back, Sean. I want to get back to what you were saying.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
We get back to what you were saying. There was like 29 counties that made up Atlanta.
Correct.
Okay. And so, folks, when you look at Atlanta, Atlanta could have basically kind of merged all those counties into one. When you look at Los Angeles, Los Angeles is, for the greater metropolis of Los Angeles, I think it's four or five counties it resides or spreads across. I think Ventura County is one. Los Angeles County is another one. San Bernardino is another one. Riverside is another one. And Orange County is another one. And you could probably say San Diego County on the north end of that, because I think San Clemente is a part of the San Diego County. So, I mean, Los Angeles is kind of sitting over as the sprawl. So what do you do about big metropolises? And when you start actually looking, the sewage systems were kind of broken down by the large metropolises that ended up merging together. I don't think that they actually started connecting pipes, but they did start consolidating trash and waste disposal, those types of things, to basically keep their costs down. That's the same thing kind of like with electricity. There were public utilities, and most all of these things were all done unconstitutionally, at least like the electricity. That was done unconstitutionally by the federal government. Good, right, bad, whatever. The bottom line is, if we're going to get right by this, we need to make sure things are done right. And until we all start agreeing the government really shouldn't be doing that, then that's when we can start actually having the conversation, well, who should and how should we do this? Because once we all agree that we need to fix the problem, now we've got everybody in. Because at this point, until people acknowledge the magnitude of the problem, we're not having that conversation. But I'm here to tell you that it is all within reason that you can create, because if you look at Seattle, it's in this county that's really big. It's called King County. And King County, even though Seattle may sprawl, that's other cities and towns like Bellevue, Renton, and so forth that are part of King County. And they have their own, you know, waste system, sewage system, blah, blah, blah. So Seattle may be the biggest city in King County, but it's not the only city. So these big cities could consider actually either creating their own county, in other words, the Seattle County and the Renton County and Tacoma County, whatever, and actually start breaking down so that the people have, because it's not about creating more government, it's about creating a better representative government and reducing our costs, creating efficiencies. Because whether we like it or not, the real cost of government is our time and our effort. But this is a self-governing system. And if you're going to allow, you know, somebody that comes along and give them full reign over you, in other words, you're going to allow people to make themselves the prince of you, the king of you, the queen of you, what have you, then you're a fool. We have an opportunity to actually have a say in what our energy strategy should be. And those strategies should be set at the local level. And so I wanted to kind of help you understand that this hybrid constitutional republic that we're blessed with, as we were talking about in this particular you know, segment that we're reading from Governor Randolph, that, you know, they didn't understand what they had. They just had the blueprint. They had this divine template. And until the people at the state level started entrusting and actually looking at the benefits of these checks and balances and so forth, and this more efficient form of government, then they started applying that at the state level. They didn't do a good job. There are certain things that they didn't like. There are certain things that they wanted to keep, the, you know, protecting cabals, what have you. But as we look at this, this hybrid constitutional republic is such an opportunity to take us into the 25th, 26th, the 30th century. Once we get constitutional compliance, everything becomes, as far as I'm concerned, easy. Because now we don't have to worry about constraining government. We're all doing our job finally, because all of government is awake, which means we, the people, and all of our public servants are all awake, and we're all firing on all cylinders, so forth and so on. So with that, I just wanted to, you know, kind of close that loop, because we ran out of time yesterday. Was there anything you wanted to add to that, though, Sean?
No, sir. I think you covered it.
Okay. So one of the things that kind of came up, and it kind of, you know, talking about poops in the street, the birthright citizenship, and the fact that we look at the Supreme Court as the final arbiters of all things. In other words, we can't do it unless the Supreme Court is going to let us. Here's my question. Sean, what type of government are we? Are we a judiciary form of government?
No, we're a Republican form of government.
Apparently we are, because we're allowing the Supreme Court to rule us and tell us what our Constitution means and what it says, when we actually have more than ample. As a matter of fact, as we read the ratification debates over the past month and a half, or however long we've been reading them now, as we read them, they've already defined what these things mean and what they say. It's the same thing with the 14th Amendment. The Congress, the congressional debates of the 14th Amendment clarified precisely what that meant. It did not mean a birthright citizenship. This was a principle that came out of the mouth of a progressive judge, and the only reason the courts are not willing to step on, you know, themselves, because it's almost like they'd have to cut their arms off. If they came out and said, you know, we had no authority to make all of these rules, it takes away their ability to make future rules. It takes away this authority that they have, this great opportunity of shaping our government, because they have no authority to do that. They've assumed that power. Actually, they didn't assume that power. It was a little, talk about poop, it was a turd given to us by Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers. This is one of the reasons why the court aggrandized the Federalist Papers as the guide. This is why the Federalist Papers is considered the gold standard in understanding the Constitution when it comes to lawyers, courts, and so forth. How dare they? When you read these ratification debates, and as we go through the Virginia debates, we're going to find out that the courts weren't really trusted at all. That's one of the reasons why they were very limited, that they didn't have any jurisdiction over common law. They didn't have any jurisdiction really within anything other than those things arising under the Constitution. And appellate, they had appellate jurisdiction over cases and controversies between a citizen and another state, or, you know, a citizen of one state suing another state, and foreigners suing states, and so forth and so on. I mean, they have this appellate jurisdiction in Article 1 or Article 3, Section 2, but the 11th Amendment wiped that out. They actually don't have that jurisdiction anymore. And they don't have the jurisdiction. There's no power in Article 3 that grants them the ability to interpret or create law or any of this stuff. Again, that was all a grant. We covered this in detail. If you go back a few months ago, It's highlighted because Sean helped me out and he gave me those, you know, those clarities, definitions of what the show is including and so forth. And if you go back a couple of months, you'll actually find where we covered the Federalist Papers and Alexander Hamilton's scheme in basically helping the court aggrandize itself. Remember that, Sean?
Yes, sir.
When we look at the concept of birthright citizenship, anybody that does the due diligence, the first time birthright citizenship was uttered in a federal court, it was the mid-1900s. Why did that happen? And we'll find out that it was literally, one, first off, it happened because the court gets away with interpreting and creating law and redefining the Constitution. Had anybody stood up and said, hold on, what you're saying goes in direct conflict. And this is where the state legislatures need to actually step in and say, hold on here. The federal court does not have the ability to redefine and rewrite that Constitution, which is what they're doing. So what do? Well, we actually have to get people to start removing these folks that are doing this. You have to start removing the jurists in your county and in your state who think they have those types of powers. And at the federal level, and I think, didn't we cover this, was it yesterday or maybe the day before, in the past couple of days, I talked about the Justice Department where Trump could easily use the Justice Department to go in and remove every jurist that voted for this birthright citizenship, just like that. Remove them. Because their vote was a direct violation of how the 14th Amendment was defined. They have no authority whatsoever to redefine anything that was put into the Constitution. And so if they want to appeal that, then that's on them. But there's no due process when we remove people from office because they've violated their oath and made themselves ineligible. It's an eligibility standard. They're no longer qualified to be in that office because they committed both moral and legal perjury by violating their oath. So, folks, you want to solve these problems? It goes right back to what I say every show. It all requires full compliance to the Constitution. Put the jurist back into the bottle. Put your governors and executives back into the bottle. Put your legislators back into the bottle. They don't have the authority to compromise using politics to say, okay, we're going to grant ourselves the ability to regulate your health care. No, we either amend the Constitution for you to do that, or you keep your hands to yourselves. Quit meddling in our affairs. So, what say you?
I say that the birthright citizenship issue is just ridiculous. It's just common sense on its face that them ruling that anyone who is born in this country, regardless of their status or their immigration status or naturalization status or whatever status, it's just completely ludicrous. There is no country in the world where that is even feasible, much less allowed. And I don't understand. So now our citizenship, people who are actually born here, the parents who are citizens, our citizenship has been completely devalued. Because what does it even mean if someone can be pregnant, hop across the border, have their baby, and meanwhile, the taxpayers are going to pay for it, for them to have their baby. And now that child is a citizen of the United States.
Yes, and this is how...
It's just ludicrous.
Right. Well, so all of these things, whether it be the invasion, whether because they're redefining what the invaders are. Oh, they're undocumented immigrants. No. Because undocumented immigrant basically means that these people came here without any intention to be an immigrant. They came
right.
here intentionally.
You have to migrate. You have to go through a process mm-hmm. to be naturalized, to be mm-hmm. part of the country.
Right.
I mean, it's not a rest stop.
Right. Nobody can just walk into any nation and say, I want to be a citizen. You have to actually apply. You have to apply, and once your application's been accepted, now you can migrate. In the old days, when, you know, we were pretty much open because the only people that were coming here were from Britain or maybe France, maybe Germany or Scandinavia, Europe. But as things started expanding, the states actually started putting banishments on people coming here. What about that? You couldn't come here and immigrate or become a citizen if you're a Mohammedan. They actually banned, every state in the Union banned Mohammedans from becoming citizens and from migrating here. That, those banishments started dropping or ending at the end of the 19th century, which is why the first mosque was built in the 20th century. I think it was in the 1920s or 1930s when the very first mosque in America was built. Why didn't they build one in the late 1700s? Because they weren't allowed to be here. They looked at their doctrine, their religion, and said, no, this is antithetical to what we believe. They're basically the enemy. They are our enemy. They've declared war against us. We acknowledge the fact that they consider us their enemy. So why would we allow them to come here?
And it's the same thing with anyone else from any other country.
Right.
I mean, there's a documented, well-documented paradigm where the Chinese are sending people over here on the premise of tourism. Then they get pregnant, or they're already pregnant, they have a child. Now the child's a citizen. They take them back to China, and then when they're old enough, they come back here, and now they're already a citizen, and they've been indoctrinated under the Chinese intelligence, Chinese,
yep,
you know, Communist Party, and they come back here and they subvert our country.
There's a term for that. It's called a cottage industry.
Yeah.
Where people learn how to create a business opportunity or political opportunity by exploiting these types of loopholes, these types of created gaps or holes in the system. So, yeah, absolutely.
It's just outrageous.
It is.
And I don't understand. And like you're talking about, the justices who agreed with this or went along with this, they should be removed. It's just disgusting. I mean, and even in their decision, the things that the quotes that came out of their decision are just, you know, ridiculous.
So
and I don't understand how.
So what's more,
two of them were appointed by Trump, and everybody's like, oh, Trump's got the Supreme Court. No, he doesn't.
Yep. Thank you.
No, he doesn't.
So what's more disgusting, the fact that they're claiming these powers of interpretation, these powers of legislation, these powers of being final arbiters and so forth, what is more disgusting is that the fact that they're claiming these powers and exercising them as weapons against us, or is our illiteracy and not doing the due diligence, learning the Constitution and holding them accountable, or is that more disgusting? What's more disgusting? Because I'm telling you,
I think on its face, their actions are more disgusting. Because, I mean, and not taking any blame or responsibility away from the citizens of the country, but over many decades, disindoctrination has taken place, mm-hmm, to where now you have several generations in a row who are completely illiterate to the function of their government.
Yeah, but
and that's why they're being led by the nose by these fraudulent actions,
okay,
of the government. But the person doing the crime, the actual person who's actually, if you're a Supreme Court justice, you're supposed to know the Constitution.
Yeah, well, we got to go for a break. We'll be right back because I think that at a macro view, we might actually see how long this has been going on to say, at what point are we, the current generation, you know, really, we can blame those people upstream. But anyway, we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so peeling back the onion, to try to be as fair as possible, when we peel back the onion, the court assumed or was granted by Congress the ability to regulate itself in the 1830s. This is when the court actually said, you know what? Under common law, under civil law, and under most all law, case law and precedents is acceptable. We don't have the ability to use case law. We've kind of been using it, but now we're going to start using it. And that's what we're going to be applying in moving forward in our processes of adjudication. So, okay, they also started interpreting law, and they basically claimed that authority, that they could interpret the law if there was a question or if they felt that the original intent had changed in their eyes. I mean, I don't know. the original intent is the original intent. And maybe the framers were wrong. This aggrandizing of interpreting and changing what the law means is tantamount to basically amending the Constitution. They don't have that authority. But the fact is, this all started happening when the framers were dying off, specifically right at the time when Hamilton was in his final stages of life, literally geriatric mode, because I believe he only lived another year after, I believe, it was 1836. I think he either passed in 1836 or 37, but it was around that time frame when they started creating their own regulations. And, you know, he was just too weak, too tired to basically say, hey, stop this. And let me just say this, too. Why is it that Madison and Jefferson never went after the courts regarding the opinions that they were providing in their rulings, because they were just opinions? Opinions had no weight. It was just an opportunity for the court, you know, for a judge to, you know, use his communication prowess and his academic, you know, knowledge to kind of dazzle people in how well he understood the law. Whether he was right or wrong, nobody could correct him because it was just an opinion, right? And everybody knows the story. Everybody has an opinion. So why didn't they say anything? Because opinions had no weight. Now, all of a sudden, opinions become the foundation of new law. They come up with an opinion that the one person, one vote principle. Next thing you know, that's transitioned itself into law. Well, hold on here. How'd that happen? Because nobody challenged the first step of getting that camel's nose into the tent and then the head into the tent. And now the camel's got the tent and we're all out. We no longer have a Republican form of government. The courts have literally taken over. The same thing with the Bar Association being taken over. The British Accredited Registry establishing itself in the 1870s literally started changing and dissolving common law throughout the states. The Supreme Court officially came out and said they will no longer review common law cases. I think this was in the 1930s under the federal or the FDR administration. As we look at how the court evolved and how this all started, most of the people, I really don't believe that, you know, if you go to law school, they're up there bragging, okay, so this all, we got all this power because of Hamilton. And Hamilton did this, and we basically did an end run, and we got away with it. We got away with this new end run, and we did this. That's not taught. What is taught is we have this power, and everybody believes that they have that power. Nobody challenges it because the Federalist Papers support it. We've read that, right?
That is correct, sir.
Okay, so because nobody's challenging it, and everybody reads it and says, well, I can't challenge that. I mean, shoot, how am I to challenge Hamilton? We're so far...
I had a time machine.
We're so far downstream from all of the changes that those who have been culpable of doing all of this now are gone, and everybody else has just been repeating. I think I might have told the story about the monkeys and the banana and the water, where they took a group of five or six monkeys. You can look this up. There was a study that they did, and they had five or six monkeys in a cage. And they put bananas, and I think they only did this once. They put bananas in the cage, and they hosed all of the monkeys down when they tried to go get the bananas. They basically, like, punished everybody for trying to have something that they didn't want. Or I should say that the zookeeper, the trainer, did not want them to have. And so... every time they introduced a new monkey, the other monkeys, when they put the bananas in the cage, the other monkeys would restrain that other monkey. What ended up happening is they ended up removing all six of the original monkeys, and all six of the new monkeys were living by the principles that were established by the original six. You don't get the bananas. Without even understanding why they don't get the bananas. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
We've been indoctrinated to a point where on every level, at the top to the bottom, we've all been indoctrinated because we're not challenging, we're not going to the source documents and saying, do they really have this authority? Well, don't waste your time. We've already established that we do. Well, hold on here. How? Where did that come from? Oh, well, and then they point to the Federalist Papers. Ah, and nobody has ever, and this is the whole point. I mean, this is why I just go, I can't believe this. Why is it that we're so, I mean, shoot, 2024, I think, is when I tripped over that. The fact that those things were never published, that they were actually written after the Constitution was ratified and so forth, and wrote that initial article. As a matter of fact, I believe you wrote an article about that too. And so how is it that we're talking 2024 from 1788 when those Federalist Papers were written? And then stuffed into the back end. And I think during the shows of the Federalist Papers, I think I commented, I don't believe Madison ever opened those documents. I don't believe Madison ever even cared about the Federalist Papers because they were just editorials that were written for the New York newspapers. That, you know, who cared? He never cited the Federalist Papers, never pointed to the Federalist Papers. They were just an artifact that was, you know, creating a public conversation, nothing official, nothing formal. And he looked at them as literally just that, editorials. Okay, so he never gave them weight. Is it Madison's fault because he didn't give weight to, hey, you know, is this the nose in the, of the camel in the tent when the justices started creating opinions, or when they, you know, did judicial review in 1800 or it was in 1801 with Marbury v. Madison? I think it was 1800, maybe it was 1801. But with Marbury v. Madison, with judicial review, you know, they didn't. And the reason they didn't do anything was because they knew at that point in time, Congress was already still compromised as the Federalists. They weren't going to regulate or ring in the court. And the president didn't have any power to do that because Jefferson was president at that point, and Madison was the Secretary of State. So they were out of the influence of Congress to say, you guys got to ring these guys in. And this is why we're living with judicial review today. Judicial review is not constitutional. It's a paradox. We're living in a paradox because there's people that talk about the limitations that we've got a limited defined government, but they're granting government to do all sorts of things, or they're allowing government to assume all these sorts of powers and so forth. So anyway, I don't see any other way around the fact that I think the buck has to stop with us. I think that we,
absolutely.
I think we have to step up and we have to start holding them accountable, period.
Yeah. And I think that it's a blessing, and we know how the Lord works in his own ways. But I think at this point, I think it's not a coincidence of the timing of their machinations and their agenda and the advent of the internet and the modern technology and information age that we're living in, and people being woken up and actually seeing the information and having access to the information that we need to address these issues. I don't think that's coincidence. And I wanted to ask you, when you were talking about like when the Supreme Court first started taking these actions where they were interpreting and creating law, do you think it was just that they just didn't pay attention, or was it that the things that they were doing and the ways they were interpreting the Constitution were beneficial to certain factions? So that's why they didn't raise any issue with it, because it was benefiting them.
I think that
like when Jimmy Carter started the Department of Education in order to get the teachers union vote.
I believe that the courts, the jurists, Marshall, understood that they couldn't just quickly go out and ban books, because if they started grabbing the Bible with a bunch of people that became illiterate over the Bible, then people would probably go and grab their Bibles and hide them and start reading them. What they had to do was they had to do this incrementally, and they had to start injecting things, but they couldn't ban things. It's kind of like the original 13th Amendment and how they just expunged it down the road, and they used the overall control of the printing of the papers and so forth, so that eventually all the old papers of people's constitutions didn't have the old 13th Amendment, and nobody noticed it. And that they didn't start doing that until after the 15th Amendment was already passed. When you look at these maniacal people with these machinations, as you use that term, apropos to what they're doing, they're executing a strategy to keep people occupied in looking at one hand while they're doing all of this nefarious stuff with their other. And so I believe that that had to be the strategy. And I believe that Hamilton spelled that out. Now, I don't have any documents to prove this, but I have heard that there have been documents in the White House or the Oval Office, and I wouldn't think that, why wouldn't they have it at the judiciary too, where the Supreme Court meets, that the Chief Justice hands it over from him to the next Chief Justice, that when Marshall did what he did, he handed over to Joseph Story, you know, these things. And when they looked at the fascia of what they were doing They saw it as a good thing. They didn't see the maniacal plan behind it. I don't think that they, you know, anybody wrote the plan down this way. I don't think that it was, okay, we're first going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, because you guys are going to ultimately basically start attacking Christianity, and you're going to support the formation of the Antichrist Church. I don't think anybody laid that strategy out in front of any of these people. I'll give you a reason why. Because when you look at Marshall, I think, was an idiot. He obviously, because his mentor was Alexander Hamilton. To choose that guy, that Hamilton was, you know, I'll just say he was shamed and he was outed as a man of moral turpitude. And he ended up leaving D.C. because he was caught in that torrid affair. He was kept in the inner circle and was a guiding hand to John Adams and other people in D.C. because of his influence and affluence. And he wasn't a rich man, so where did that money come from? Oh, you know, I believe it was coming from Britain. I have no proof of this. I just say I believe. So as I look at how everything was being done, I don't even think Alexander Hamilton knew how this was all going to lay out, because I think he was kind of a guy that believed in prayer. I mean, he may have been a sinner and so forth, but I think he had some semblance or respect for the Creator, because we kind of see that in all of these men. Now, actually, with Hamilton, I have to back up, because Hamilton was the one that wanted to stop prayer in the convention. So, I mean, he was a very questionable creature, if you understand what I'm saying. But what he laid out and handed to Marshall, basically giving him the Federalist Papers and saying, you need to bolster these up and ignore the ratification debates. You need to make sure you marginalize the ratification debates and you use these. And then I think he pointed out to Marshall in those judiciary sections at the very end that he put in there, I said, go look at, you know, I'm sure he said, go look in these things. You're going to see that there is this this insinuation that you're going to be able to have these powers, even though those weren't a part of the ratification, because Marshall was a part of the ratification debate process. We're going to read some of his citations here. And so Marshall, I believe, you know, kind of kept that, you know, in his hat. And when Joseph Story replaced him, Joseph Story said, okay, you know, this seems like a good thing that we can actually have a little bit more say with the government, and we're good godly men. Why wouldn't we do good things? Yeah, I'm okay with that. Who's not okay with assuming more power and being able to, you know, be more of a name recognized in history? Because who remembers who the very first justice was? Very few. I mean, you have to be a historian to start remembering that James Wilson was kicked off the court. It wasn't until, you know, Marshall and beyond that where the court really started taking a higher and higher pedestal in our eyes. So as Joseph Story took over, one of the interesting things, and I got to point this out because I pointed this out in my book, Joseph Story was a creature as well. But he gave us one thing that, to me, helps everybody understand our legal system at the time. And I believe Joseph Story and his hand in aggrandizing power, he had no idea what he was doing, or because if he did, he wouldn't have done it. Because if you look in my book, I talk about the three witnesses of how the court system was based and predicated upon people who were godly people who believed in a creator. In America, you could not take a case to court if you didn't believe in God. And you had to be a Christian. Not only that, but you had to be a Christian in good standing in your local community. In other words, going to church, you know, and kind of abiding by the commandments and the laws and so forth. Well, where's GR getting this? Actually, the first document was the hearing of Thomas Jefferson, and actually you'll find it in Dumas Malone's six-part series, of Thomas Jefferson, and I think it was the Virginian, when he was the governor of Virginia. And as the secession was going down, when he was stepping down as governor, and I forget the new governor was coming in, Randolph or Edmund or something like that, that was replacing him, Jefferson didn't show up because Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold and the British forces basically chased Jefferson from Monticello into the woods westward, away from Richmond, so he couldn't get to Richmond in time at all. He didn't even make it there. And so the governor that was supposed to be, you know, taking over, and Jefferson was supposed to pass over the mantle of the governorship to him, and he felt snubbed. And so he opened a charge that basically Jefferson abandoned his post. And he wanted to prosecute that as the governor. So they brought in a circuit court judge that traveled in to basically hear the case. And when the case started, this is in Dumas Malone's book, when that case started, the sheriff basically told the judge who were Christians in good standing. The reason that is because you can't bear witness. If you're not a Christian in good standing, they won't take your testimony as a witness. So what ended up happening was he pointed to Jefferson and says he's not a Christian in good standing because he wasn't going to church. So the judge basically called all the officers of the court and Mr. Jefferson, who was also an officer of the court defending himself, up to the bench. And he said, Mr. Jefferson, I understand that you're not a Christian in good standing. Therefore, I, as an officer of the court, you can cross-examine, you can ask questions, but I will not allow you to bear testimony in your defense. And so dismissed Jefferson. Now you see and understand the reason behind why Jefferson wrote, I believe there should be a wall of separation between church and state to the Danbury Baptists, because he felt cited that by that angle that the church had over government. And so he felt that, you know, we should all be, you know, free. You should still be able to bear testimony. So right, wrong, or indifferent, that was the first document that basically proved that there were courts that were actually keeping or refraining from anybody that wasn't Christian in good standing. Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America noted the exact same thing in upstate New York when an atheist tried to basically petition the court over a property case or something like that, suing somebody else. And they dismissed his case with prejudice because he was not a Christian in good standing. And that was in the newspaper. And Alexis de Tocqueville made a little hay out of that. He goes, wow, I can't believe this. And in Joseph Story's biography, his own self-biography, he talks about why infidels were not allowed to bear testimony in our court system because they had no credit with the court, no credit with God. If they couldn't believe that they could be accountable in an afterlife to a creator and an omnipotent power, then they could not be trusted. And so, wow, that was a big swimming hole or a little rat hole that had a lot of water in it. But the whole point is that Joseph Story was a man that did, and he was a very religious man. So I don't think that, you know, he looked at what he was doing as real sin. He thought that what we're doing is good. I believe that the plan was, the next stages of the plan came a little bit later, once America had become more tolerant towards non-Christian things, become a little more tolerant with this. All these things slowly, we read in the Bible, line upon line, precept upon precept, right?
Yes, sir.
I believe that Satan works the same way, line upon line, precept upon precept. He doesn't expose the entire plan to everybody. There are very few times where we could see how deep the evil exposure had been with certain people. I'll give you a good case in point as well, and I don't mean to take up the whole show, but when you go into studying those Fabians that came to America from Britain, some of these people were absolutely depraved, you know, evil people. And there was one or two of them. I know there was at least one that had documentation, their own handwriting and so forth, where they were talking in like a journal about the overall plan of destroying the family, that it was about promoting all forms of sexuality, you know, the getting people to practice homosexuality, incest, bestiality, any form of, you know, debauchery possible. That they wanted to break all of those barriers. They wanted to attack, you know, chastity. They wanted to attack the church and chaste values, those types of things. And but they couldn't expose that right off. So in some cases, you'll actually find somebody actually had a little bit of the playbook, more of the playbook than they should have. But I believe when it was going from, you know, from justice to justice, and I believe from president to president, the next president might get exposed to a little bit more. And, okay, you're going to include this and this, because it was handed to them. And they knew, I don't know if you've ever seen, you know, some of these insinuations where the globalists, you know, kind of mark their territory to prove that they, you know, they own the kings, the monarchs, and so forth, because every once in a while you see a king show up in public with a black eye, or, you know, like they've been beaten or what have you. And so because they want them to know that, you know, you're not in control, you're there to do our job, we put you there. And so when they get the orders to do what needs to be done, the globalists, they understand, okay, this person's going to play games. This person will actually, you know, do our bidding, or this person may be hesitant. We'll wait till next time around. But it's line upon line, precept upon precept, and it's going down both channels. And that's how I see this. And this is why I think that this is how it's been so hard to discover all of these things. I mean, we find these things, but you really have to do your due diligence. This is why I abandoned the whole conspiracy theory, you know, in spending all my time in that, because it can consume you. There's just so much, and every time you unturn a rock, you find another thing. That's exactly what happened last year when I started examining the Utah Enabling Act. It brought me to the Public Lands Act as I went backwards from the 1880s, 1890s, all the way up to the 1780s of the public lands, or the surveying of land and those types of things, of, you know, how the government had these responsibilities of surveying lands, but they didn't have the responsibility of the selling and the keeping of the proceeds and owning and all of that as public land. And so bottom line is, it can consume you. And I think what's important is understanding that what they can do and what they can't do, and holding them to that. Once we all get to that, then we can start saying, you know, there's some of these things are good. Let's figure out how we can fix this without giving them the power over that. And unfortunately, I took up the whole show. So I'm going to give you the go back, Sean, when we come back. So that, you know, all these things, hopefully you're writing these notes down. Only he said this, this, and this, because I didn't want to do a full monologue. I wanted to share these things so, you know, we could see some of these histories and cases in point that have helped, I think, illuminate, you know, precisely how this plan has kind of like a snowball as it's gone down. It's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and grander. Anyway, folks, there you go. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.